So, what was there a particular catalyst that brought about the circular economy strategy? Was there something that made the European Commission decide that this was a turning point or an essential thing to do?
I think the challenge is in no way new. It's been around for, I think, the better part, I mean, in terms of policy terms, for the better part of the last 25 years. It's just that we went through a couple of policy loops, and in 2011, I think with the then Commissioner Janez Potocnik, there was a clear recognition that we needed to approach it in a form that would put it squarely into the terms of economics. And the starting point then was a work on resource efficiency. And the way of approaching this was that we adopted in 2011 the resource efficiency roadmap, and then went on to work with a high-level panel of people from all walks of life, who ended up, which was the high-level panel on resource efficiency, and which presented us with a 14 recommendations in 2014, coincidence. And then it became very clear that we had macroeconomic recommendations, which, as we all understand, are always very nice. But then, how does that relate to microeconomics, and how does it relate to the company, to the administrative entity level? And that was the starting point
So
of
there
reflection.
wasn't, was there a sense that there was market failure or that the system was going down a particular route and this was not sustainable?
I think both.
Both.
But it was clear also that without a clear policy signal, there was hardly going to be any change.
Yeah. So the trajectory was here and not here.
But
Yeah.
there's also a time in the middle of the economic crisis where we would not have expected to be able to work on piecemeal messages and actions here and there, because the overall climate was bad. But we needed a different narrative where the ambition of resource efficiency and environmental sustainability would be joined with a positive economic message.
Agree.
And that
Because
came.
often they're seen as in conflict. And I when I read the original circular economy action plan and
The one
the
of
material,
2014.
yes, and then the one in 2016, I thought, I think they have nailed it. So I was very pleased because I completely agree. They've often been seen as being in conflict, and the legacy and the engine of industry and community consumption is here, and how do you turn the ship around? So it's a very significant strategy in my mind, and I think that it has having ripples not just here within Europe but around the world, and it ties in with so many other things that you have done. What do you see that industry, particularly let's talk about the plastics one, is able to adapt? You've had, you said, numerous conversations with them. You have confidence that they will be able to adapt?
I think that the
Or it's essential that they do, it's not optional.
well, I think that statement I would certainly agree with. There is no plastic industry. There is a number of sectors that rely on plastic as an essential material. And so when you talk to Plastic Europe, you actually talk to those people who produce primary plastics. But that's sort of an intermediate material. So the challenge, or the thing is, how will the range of industrial sectors and business sectors that you know, produce and use plastic for their products and services, how will they relate to a new plastics economy? Because you have
You're very right that you've identified that plastics go into so many different sectors, from healthcare to clothing to automotive to the building industry and so forth, that it flows ubiquitously into everything.
Yes. So when you look at the you know, the basis on which we had sort of the factual basis that we had to look at for the plastic strategy, we had to see, when you look at the European market, and of course we had to start from the European market, you had to see that, you know, 40% of the demand for plastic is for packaging, and 60% of the waste is packaging. So it's very obvious where the main challenge lies. Whereas when you look at the applications for electronics, automotive and buildings, those are long-term build-up stocks that remain in use for, if you talk buildings, something like 40 years. If you talk cars, something like 15 years max, and electronics, a couple of years. And they're usually materials that are high added value, and many of them can actually be reused and recycled. The same cannot easily be said about packaging. And so the main thing was also, and when you look at all our reflections on this one, currently we're using 7% by and large of fossil stock for plastic production. If we don't do anything about the trends, in 2050 will be 20%. So I think that's not something that is...
That means you have an incredible reliance upon an industry which is also under strain as well.
So.
Yes, when I spoke with Ton Emmons, he was of the view that with the circular economy strategy, there will be a restructuring in the industry which will see a number of European resin manufacturers start to... become more involved in recycling because their plants are becoming old, and in order for them to have a continued footprint and life in Europe, they will have to embrace recycled feedstock far more than they have to date. So he predicts that there will also be more vertical integration and a change in the structure of the industry.
Which would be good, because what we've been preaching or saying to our industrial partners is, you know, integrated value chain management is key.
Yes.
And it's also key to enable a circular a loop on plastics, because in order to feed things back, you need to know what comes in.
And the chemistry of it.
So, therefore, I'm sure Werner spoke about that as well. In complementary to the plastic strategy, you have to look at the communication and the interface between chemicals, waste, and policies, because that's a complementary set of actions.
Yes, and he explained that very well. Yeah. One of the things I'm very interested to discuss is the approach you have taken in relation to procurement and recycling. So you have requested or encouraged companies and associations to come forward and pledge. Can you describe that, what it is that you have decided to do and how you believe that will have an impact?
I think, quite honestly, when writing Annex 3 of the communication, we probably underestimated the challenge for industry to come up with such a pledge. Quite honestly, I think after so many
discussions... Before you go into that, can you describe for me how you see the pledge is going to work? So it is asking companies to make a commitment for recycled content.
Yeah.
I mean, any amount the they...
Annex 3, in a very generic way, says, we want you to tell us by the end of June how much recycled material you will integrate in new products, directly or indirectly, and how you will do it, and what will be the way of verification for doing it. And I think it's the combination of the three that challenges industry, and where we've seen that pledges that were made at the World Economic Forum, in, you know, on other conferences like our Oceans Conference and so on, they haven't been able to translate that into this rather hard and clearly described pledge that we're asking for, because the objective is 10 million additional tons of recycled material in products by 2025, which is more or less a tripling of the current amount. So that's challenging. And the thing is, the sort of Damocles that hangs over them is that, in a way, we are saying, and if the pledge does, if the result of the pledge shows that this is not happening, because basically our pitch to them was, if you can demonstrate that you will meet the 10 million, you know, just by doing it.
Yes. Cool. No need to regulate.
Yeah. Mm. But if we see that this, for whatever reason, is becoming very difficult or is not happening, then the next commission will have to say, okay, well, we need to think about mandatory recycled content.
So what sort of examples are you hearing about that companies or industries are proposing in order to...
Not much yet.
Oh, it's still early May.
It is early May. No, but I mean, what I have heard and what colleagues have heard from industry is, first, if we are making a public pledge into that system, we're bound by it, so we cannot risk failing on it in a spectacular way, because that basically gives bad publicity, and we don't want to do that.
One of the things that I suggested to Werner was, we'll make it so that there's something in June, and then they can up their pledge or add additional information next year, like the auditing or something like that.
Basically, what we're saying currently internally, I mean, just between you and me, is, okay, we may have to give them a little bit more time. So,
yes. But keep to the whole.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. Yeah. That's fine. Right. Sit. Yeah, sit. So from my perspective, the pledging is clearly a big challenge in that regard.
Yes. But it's an exciting step, because it's something that has not been successful. Though, mind you, you know, we have a scheme for reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. We have schemes for dealing with mercury. We have a range of schemes for different. I guess it's the quantum of the change which you're proposing that companies and industry associations undertake. In terms of costs, though, immediately people say that when there is such a substantive change, this will bring about increased costs for compliance, increased costs for companies to undertake this. What's your response to that?
When you embed that into a systemic change, we should be able to keep the cost down. And the problem is, we have been in a vicious cycle where every actor along the value chain has said, I would, if he and he would do the same. And the next one is saying, well, yes, I mean, just to put it in slang, the brand owner said, oh, we're glad to use recycled material if it was available in sufficient quantity and in a good quality and at the right price. Well, you can always dream of everything. But then the converter would say, yes, we'd love to do that, but I can't get it from the recycler. The recycler said, well, I'd love to invest if I had the assurance of a stable supply relationship. And the converter saying, I can't tell that to you as long as the brand owner doesn't.
So, it's a circular problem.
It's a circular problem. You never move. Yeah. Now, with what we're trying to do, we're trying to create an additional volume on the market. So if you have already a significant industry pledge on saying, okay, there is room for, you know, 5, 7, 10 additional millions of recycled material, then the recycler will say, oh yes, well then I will start to invest.
Yes.
And he will say to the EPR system, to the local or regional authority, I will be able to take X additional amount of such.
Because I have a customer who wants
it. Yeah. Yes. And so for them, it becomes more interesting to collect and sort, which means they have more of an interest to bring people to actually, you know, don't throw it all. So it's a whole chain.
Exactly. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I like it, because we have exactly the same challenges in Australia, that the economics of the collection and the reprocessing and delivery to the customer and to find and source the material is difficult, and it has to compete with virgin feedstock. So no wonder companies prefer to get virgin feedstock, because they bring up their supply and it's delivered tomorrow, and they know exactly how much they're paying, and they know they've got the data sheet and they know exactly what it contains. So to try and reinvent a system to augment and supplement that is very difficult. So I think you've done very well.
And I think what we've done in addition, I mean, last week the Commission published its proposal for the next multi-annual financial framework.
Yes.
Which is our sort of financial framework for the period 2021 to 2026. Mm-hmm. And in that one of the proposals is that member states should pay a contribution to the EU budget based on the volume of non-recycled packaging waste. So
that again, and member states will pay a contribution
to the EU budget based on the volume of non-recycled plastic packaging. So
specifically packaging.
Well, why packaging? Because we have statistical data on that one.
Yes.
So that was what, like 80 cents
per kilo. Which incidentally is the price of 1 kilo of recycled material. So it's a
good incentive.
It's 100% taxation. I think it's, and we'll see how that goes in political negotiations. But I think there is a consistent story that we're pushing.
In Australia we call it market failure, where you have to correct it somehow, and by putting a price as a tax on non-compliance, or you, in a sense, you're lifting the floor price for them to do it locally. Mm-hmm. So the question is, do I pay that as a tax to the EU, or do I ensure that that is
recycled,
a cost or a subsidy for my local reprocessing? Yeah. So you're incentivizing, I hate that word, you're providing significant incentive for companies to do more locally.
I mean, we had long discussions with.
How are they going to measure, though?
You have
enough data to know that.
We have a system for gathering the statistics. Okay. It's part of the Eurostat work. Okay. Otherwise we wouldn't do it. Because obviously it would have been better or even more ambitious to have a tax on all plastic that is non-recycled. Mm. But on that one, we don't have the reliable statistics. So we had to go with what...
So that goes to the member states, who then would say to their regional and local governments, this is something you're going to have to work out how to collect.
Well, I mean, the simplest is if you're not ambitious as a government, you just pay.
Mm.
And then nothing changes. Mm. But most likely governments will not like to pay.
No.
So they will say, okay, well, there's another option. So they will say, okay, let's increase the collection rate, let's increase the recycling rate. That way we'll pay less.
And whatever the means is, whether it's a product stewardship scheme, if there's not one already in place, or some other measure.
It's part of a policy trend, because up to now, own resources for our budget have simply been statistical, which means on customs duties, on VAT, and that was not policy relevant. Now, for the first time, the Commission has made a suggestion to use the raising of own resources also for policy purposes. And that is the three proposals that we've made. And it's an innovative...
That's a significant shift.
And it's challenging.
Yeah.
It's very challenging. So there's no guarantee of success, for obvious reasons. But it's...
So therefore, what is your position now on incineration of waste and residual waste?
To be avoided.
It is to be, but have you made a statement on...
In 2016, we issued a communication on the topic of waste to energy, which clearly established the Commission position on the use of incineration.
Right.
And
along with anaerobic digestion for organics. Yeah. Because it all comes under that silly one umbrella.
The thing is that when you look at incineration, there's one use that we will continue to have, which is to dispose of undesirable material. Because if you want to clean up the material cycles, certain materials will have to go. So, and if you want to take them out of circulation, well, you better incinerate, make them inert, and then landfill it. Mm. I mean, that's sort of, you'd have to clean up the mess of the past. I mean, there's no choice.
Yes.
Then for certain countries with a very high landfilling rate, incineration might be a short-term solution for high landfill, to move away from high landfill rates.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean that we are in favor of investing in new incineration capacities. We're just in favor of using the existing incineration capacity to the fullest.
With
the waste package that we just concluded with the Parliament and Council, it, by its definition, it puts a brake on landfilling and on incineration. Because we have a maximum of landfilling of 10% by 2025, and we have recycling targets between 65 and 70 on some of the other categories, which, if you combine the two, makes it clear how much you can possibly use for incineration. There will also be a compulsory separate collection of organic waste.
Yeah.
And as a compulsory separate collection of textiles, in addition to the separate collection of packaging and plastics and all of that.
Mm.
So all which should facilitate the putting the streams of waste into a possible economic use of the resources that are in there. So from our point of view, we actively discourage the establishment of additional incineration capacity. And that is one of the key discussions we'll also have in the context of future funding that we give out. Of course, there may be member states then that decide to fund that
themselves.
On themselves, and there's nothing we can do about that.
Right, okay. Just one final thing. So in terms of jobs and economic change, do you see that the strategy will clearly provide for more jobs or different jobs within Europe? What do you think is going to happen as a result of the circular economy strategy and the plastics one?
There are things that we think might happen, but there is very little robust evidence for it. The numbers that are floating around ever since the Ellen MacArthur study, I mean, it's all modeling.
Mm.
So there are several considerations we have on that. First, by expanding the system for waste collection, sorting, and treatment, and by additional investment in that areas, we will, of course, create additional jobs. There have been quite some criticism from the trade union, say, well, you're creating very nasty jobs. But, you know, this is work that needs to be done as well. And a lot of the discussion in Europe was about the lack of availability of jobs for lower skilled people.
Mm.
And those would be local jobs for lower skilled people. So in many instances, it would be for people the first step out of the informal sector or out of a very precarious situation into this one. And I mean, you can say, well, everybody should have a PhD, but you know, it's not going to happen.
I don't believe so.
So that's the first area we will create jobs. Secondly, by having a narrow loop on certain materials, we will actually encourage more manufacturing in Europe.
Mm.
So after 2008, a lot of the manufacturing capacity has left. And this is part of the strategy, because that's also why it's been close to the heart of the political masters. Like, it is actually can be seen as a part of an industrial policy strategy. So we trust that with a narrow loop, we'll bring manufacturing jobs back to Europe. And then, of course, we want to give an incentive to innovative business practice and innovative products.
Yes.
And when I talk to people around, there is a lot of creativity around in Europe still.
Mm.
and so trying to help them to get into the market. So I think I would say between those three areas, we are confident that we'll, first of all, compensate any potential job loss that would come in view of some products no longer being desirable, but also on top of that, actually create new and additional jobs. So yes, we're fairly confident. Do we have the numbers? Do we have studies to prove that? There are many studies around, but they're all projections and modeling as things go. So anybody will tell us, who will tell you, we will create 1 million jobs between now and 2030. Maybe, but, you know, in the end...
I know anecdotally through conversations that I have with people in Australia that they've said we would invest another $200 million if we knew that there was a customer for this material. Yeah. Or I would invest another $1 million in my plant if I knew I had a customer for this material. So we hear that. But yes, it's a question of collecting data where previously we have not collected data. Yeah. So while I've shown you our plastics strategy, it does not actually collect the number of jobs in the sector. It's very focused on plastics. If for a little extra, they could also gather data on the number of jobs and people employed by different polymer and all that sort of stuff. So
we've got the building blocks. But I think what we see is different sectors buying into the narrative, and as I said in the elevator, saying in order for us to stay in business, we actually have to change.
Yes,
I think that's very much the approach. Obviously, for the finance department and for the boards, they would sort of they like stability and they like to continue to do things as they did. The politics is not favorable to that, so there will have to be adjustments and. Let's not kid ourselves. There will be losers. Those who cannot or don't want to adapt, they will suffer in consequence. And there will be companies in Europe suffering. There will be producers from outside Europe who will suffer. But I mean, they will all suffer in the same way. We'll be not discriminating in the way of...
But conversely, as I said to you, the mood at the European Plastics Recycling Conference was so buoyant.
Yeah.
There were... How many were there? I think there were about 300-400 people there. There was 100 exhibitors. I was just looking. I thought I brought the program, but you've got it anyway. It was quite astonishing, the number of people and comments and the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Infrastructure and Water Management who opened was very clear about the directions and that it will change. She was very positive, I thought. She wasn't defensive. She was quite calm and determined that this is the way that the plastics in Europe will go.
Well, I think it's we are struggling with
a perception.
The perception from many sides that we have published an anti-plastic strategy. It comes back to me all the time. And they're saying, well, no, but just because the commission...
I don't have that at all.
No, that's very good. But it gets to me all the time from journalists and other. And then, but we're very clear that this is a strategy to make plastic fit for a circular economy. Which is equally challenging, I think. But I think it's something that we're also linked to the fact we also have to bring the same information to the consumer, to the buyer, because there's still a bias saying, well, if I get something made out of recycled material, it's not as good as the real thing. Virgin is better, and so on and so forth.
Don't say that about steel.
Yeah, or aluminium. Yeah, absolutely.
Or second-hand houses.
Yeah, well, most of us live in second-hand
houses. Exactly. Exactly. To illustrate, my second-hand hose, or, I put the same clothes on that I was wearing last week, I don't wear new clothes every day.
I think the challenge is when you look at the circular economy strategy, we're trying to deal with production, with consumption, with waste management, and with secondary raw materials. And that's in the plastic strategy, we're dealing with all of them in one go. And but there is an important element of binding the consumer in, which means, of course, that in the first instance, and that's our challenge to industry, you actually have to make those products available. Mm-hmm. Because what doesn't exist, even the most, the best intentioned consumer cannot buy.
Yeah.
And the second is then, but then they need to be positioned in marketing and in the shops so that people actually recognize them, mm-hmm. and that they can actually make a choice. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we'll have to look at, is enabling them to make the choice enough? Are they going to make a right choice, or do we need to help them?
Well, I think that's the role of government. The role of government is not to stand back and watch it all happen. The role of government is to play a part in the market. Otherwise, you have completely unfettered anything. One thing I do note about the strategy was, when I was surprised, and I mentioned this to the guys yesterday when I met them at Plastics Europe, was that it said actually not as much as I thought it would say about litter. So maybe it's because in Australia we have a different culture, and the culture is different, and that is that littering is bad and it is the responsibility of the individual. So we have litter campaigns in television advertising, in radio. You have the EPA, our Environmental Protection Authority. There is a hotline. You can ring them up and you can tell them that so-and-so threw a cigarette butt out their window, and they do. They do, or people take a photograph, or they take someone's details and they send it to the EPA if they have littered. So there's a different culture.
Mind you, the existing waste legislation includes provisions on litter.
Uh-huh.
And there is many member states, there is, in consequence of that provision, there are anti-littering laws. Now,
whether
they're enforced is another thing. I mean, but you can't put the policeman next to every citizen.
No, but we're asking the citizens to become the police. So the citizens now, I mean, we still have litter, but people will walk along and they'll see some litter and they will pick it up and put it in the bin. But it's not their litter. Ellen,
you did discuss with Rihanna the issue of single-use plastics yesterday.
Yes, yes.
So I think there is a complement in that regard.
Absolutely, and that's what I think. Yeah, but I'm only making that observation to you, that the two in concert, because it means that we have a community that is also self-monitoring and also helping clean up the environment. By ensuring that collectively we're doing the right thing, and the blame is not put upon the company, it's also equally shared responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I just mentioned that because I thought that was something. It didn't occur to me until we arrived in Europe and we saw the amount of litter.
But I mean, the thing is, that's the logic. That's the logic about taking certain measures. You don't litter a car, and you don't litter
your house,
building insulation.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're involved in a very criminal activity.
Yes.
And you usually don't litter your car tire. Well, that happens more often. But you do litter all the things that the little things that you have, the crisp packets and not to talk about bottles. Cigarette butts, and bottles and plastic bags and things like that. Yes, but here I think then there is a justification for actually intervening on whether those products should be on the market and what should be the cost for the consumer of such products put in the market to change their behavior, to change their habits. And I think it's part. We did a specific action on plastic bags a couple of years back, which is showing very good results. So plastic bags are, if you look 10 years back, everybody in Europe was using loads of plastic bags. In the shops, because they were always handed out for free. There's in the supermarket. And it's changing dramatically. Mm-hmm. I think that's
a good instance of how it can change.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Hugo.
Well, it was a pleasure. I'll hand you over to Christine.
Yes, maybe we'll go.